I have mentioned this before, but I did a lot of speech and debate growing up. Speech and debate was practically like my lifeblood in some ways. And so when I was debating, there was one topic that I kept on getting, and it didn't really make any sense to me because I was a little confused why I kept getting the same exact debate topic again and again. And it was about high-speed rail, whether or not, particularly the United States, should institute a high-speed rail system. And don't get me wrong, it was a very interesting topic, and I did enjoy debating it, but it followed me wherever I went. In one debate event, even in another debate event, in the same event, it happened twice in the same year, and part of me was just so curious what about this topic was enticing. And ultimately, it didn't matter much to me because I had a really good argument against it. And for it, of course, but I had a really, really good argument against it. And that was the idea of eminent domain. Hi, welcome to Jackie On, a podcast where I, Jackie, talk about my opinions on a bunch of different topics. This episode is Jackie On Eminent Domain, and how the scope of how it can be used is a lot wider than I ever thought possible. So, first of all, I want to talk about what eminent domain is. It's called different things around the world, also known as compulsory acquisition or expropriation, but it's basically when the government decides to acquire property against the will of its owner in order to fulfill some kind of public purpose. And eminent domain in of itself is like a right for governments to be able to take this property. There's a couple issues with it as seen throughout the world. It's not always taken for public good, which I'll get to. Oftentimes, the qualification for the government to even take someone's property is that it needs to be for just compensation, which is typically considering like market value. However, there is not always just compensation in a lot of cases, and it can be below market value or no compensation at all. Also, whether or not this ruling can be overturned through a court system differs again internationally. And one of the most common uses for eminent domain is building infrastructure. So if we were to build a high-speed rail system in the United States, we would need to take thousands of people's homes, give them some form of compensation, hopefully, and then build that up again. And so that was kind of the argument that I used, is that at the end of the day, you can't just build massive infrastructure out of land, because in the United States particularly, most land is owned by someone or something. Some of it is getting no use out of it, so maybe it's like an abandoned parking lot and it might be better to have eminent domain and turn it into something unique. But other times it's people's homes where they lived for generations, and taking that away from them causes a huge strain and burden. And so if we think about places in the past where eminent domain has been used, one of the very popular ones is a lot of the freeways or that kind of infrastructure within the United States. So that's a really popular idea of how infrastructure has been gotten from eminent domain. So for this, I kind of want to focus on three different case studies that show how eminent domain was used differently around the world. And the first one I want to talk about is Dodger Stadium, also called the Battle of Chavez Ravine. So, to give a little background on this situation, in 1950, in Los Angeles, there were about 600 households in Chavez Ravine, with about 85% of the residents being Mexican-American, because there's lots of housing segregation. So, Chavez Ravine had utilities, but they didn't have light and no paved roads, because the government wasn't interested in developing it, because this is where all the Mexican-Americans went. This is where all the people they didn't really want to think about went and lived, because it was cheap and affordable, but also because of that segregation. But in July of 1950, the government decided that they should turn this area into public housing, kind of like the big sky rises we see, something so that a ton of people could live there. And they promised all of the residents who live there that, hey, we're going to kick you out, but we're going to give you a new place to stay. So you will be able to live in this new public housing that we create. And so they ended up pushing out a lot of families, giving them money and so forth. However, because this was a public housing project in the area, it was governmentally seen as too socialist, and so it ended up not even happening at all. So not all the families were kicked out. There's a couple who were remaining, but at the end of the day, a ton of families got displaced for no reason. And so this land kind of just sat there for 7 years, with some families still living on it, until the Dodgers, the baseball team, struck a deal with the city to take over the land. Now, this was super, super contentious, because it was considered being illegal to transfer property taken via eminent domain for public usage to a private company, because where's the public benefit in that? But somehow the courts or the lawyers the Dodgers had whatever details were hashed out, was able to argue that it was for public benefit because it was a sports stadium, and that constituted public benefit. And thus, the Dodgers were able to take the land and build the Dodger Stadium. But wait, what about those couple of families that were still living there? That is part of the Battle of Chavez Ravine. There are about 20 remaining families that were kicked out, and they were forcibly removed. It wasn't like, hey, we're taking your property, and they're like, cool, okay, you can have it. No, it was people were dragged out of their homes, their homes were destroyed by the city, and they were not given great compensation. So in total, 1,800 families were displaced. One family got $17,500, but there's unclear records of compensation for all the other families, and there has been some records saying that they were not evaluated at market value, and it was quite unjust. And so this is still contentious to this day. I know the Dodgers just won a World Series. Go Dodgers. I am from LA, so I really do appreciate the Dodgers as a team, but this is part of the history that cannot be forgotten, is whether or not the Dodgers had a hand in displacing 600 households, they still displaced 20 families, and also took over property that could have been developed for housing or something else to build a stadium. And so that's important context to think of, that when we think of eminent domain, who's really getting their control and their hands on this land? Is it truly just going to be the government for, you know, whatever governmental purposes they have? Or is it also going to be private properties and private stakeholders who want access to this land in order to develop it in a way that benefits them and could be spun to talk about, you know, a good of a community or something similarly? So that's something we really need to watch out for, and kind of brings me into the second case, which is about complete land ownership, or Singapore's economic domination. So, a little background into this case study. In 1949, the state ownership of land in Singapore was 31%. And this is while it was a crown colony of the UK. So the strict rules of whether or not state ownership was really owning it is kind of contentious. But regardless, they had about 30% of their land. So, in 1959, Singapore separated from the United Kingdom and then achieved its independence by seceding from Malaysia in 1965. And at this time, they were facing some severe housing shortages and really wanted to develop infrastructure. And so if you see images of Singapore during this time, there's a lot of boats, there's a lot of like houses that are kind of built. It doesn't really look like what you'd see as a city. It kind of looks like not very wealthy, the land is not super well developed, and so they really wanted to change this. And so in 1967, they passed the Land Acquisition Act. There were a couple clauses to this act. The first one was the power to acquire private land, so just eminent domain in general. The second is the inability of affected landowners to object to the compulsory acquisition. So they call it compulsory acquisition here, but basically, if someone took your land, you couldn't say anything about it. So like if I owned my house and I was having a good time, you can't stop the government from taking it away from me. I can't do anything about it. Third is that the landowners would be compensated much less than market value. So this is kind of an abusive act in which you're giving people below what they would get if they just sold their homes by themselves. This was changed in 2007 so that it would actually be at market value. However, prior to 2007, when the majority of the land that they obtained, they were able to get it very cheap because they legally put it into place that they could get it at less than market value, which I think is just crazy. And lastly, four is the formation of an appeals board to formally judge on compensation. So while you could not object the compulsory acquisition, you might be able to object the amount of money you're getting, and so there's a board that would help judge what compensation should be given. So some checks and balances, but not really a lot. And so because of this law that was put into place by 1985, the state ownership of land was 76%. So instead of private communities being the wealthiest, it now became the government who was the wealthiest in Singapore. And now as of 2025, the state actually owns 90% of all of its land. And another point that is important to mention is Singapore is also artificially creating its own islands. So they will basically put land to create islands, and so this new land that they're creating is also owned by them. So when this 90% could increase, whether or not they buy up other places or if they're just creating more land artificially. And another interesting fact is that Singapore actually has one of the highest of home ownership rates, but that's not necessarily true. Home ownership in the way that citizens all get their housing through 99-year leases from the government. And so ownership in the sense that, yes, they are all paying in their leases, but no one actually owns their homes. It's very difficult to own a home in Singapore because there's no land that isn't owned by the government. And what's really interesting about this is how Singapore generates its wealth. So 30% of Singapore's wealth and GDP and all that kind of comes from income taxes. Goods and services taxes, another 10%. And then if you look at motor vehicle taxes, net investment returns contribution, how they've reinvested their land sales, any property taxes, rental income, development charges, all of this is land-related income, is about 50% of their income as a state. The country of Singapore, the ownership of land is what generates them their wealth. So if you look at it today, you look at it and you see like any city, massive city that could be in the US. Big skyscrapers, lots of light pollution, lots of cars, lots of high rises, because these high rises are the houses that people live in. It's a very, very developed city because the government owns so much land. So this is interesting because the only reason they were able to really pull this off is because they were coming out of independence, right? Their country is a state, the ideas of the state were still not quite defined. And so they wanted to boost their wealth and really develop in some way. And the best way they decided to do this was through land ownership and reinvesting in that land. However, the same process could not at all happen in a place like the United States, where private ownership is so heavily emphasized, specifically for individuals. And so it's really interesting to see private versus public land wealth, because we look at wealth as through assets and through the land you own, and Singapore has really capitalized on that in a state way as opposed to just an individual way. And that brings me to my third case study, which is land reform or redistribution of land in South Africa. So in South Africa, there's a huge movement to expropriate the state because the vast, vast majority of land is in private ownership and not actually owned by the state or a tribe or protected. So just to give a little bit of background on this one, this is South Africa, which is in Africa, which has undergone lots of colonization. And so before colonization, in Africa in general, it was handled very differently when you look towards eminent domain. It still did exist, but oftentimes one of the common trends you'd find is that either they didn't really have it to the degree of like a state mandation, but they more had it on smaller scales and it was on land utilization for the greater good of a community. So if someone had land that they weren't using, okay, it might be put in towards the community to be used. But a lot of the time, ownership was a bit more communal and less strictly state-owned, and so you see those differences in terms of the colonial era versus post-colonial era. So in 1913, the Native Land Act in South Africa restricted black people from buying or renting land in quote-unquote white South Africa, which led to their forced removal, and that continued in 1994, where under apartheid and colonialism, black-owned land was seized. And so ultimately, 86% of agricultural land owned by white South Africans, and those white South Africans made up less than 11% of the population. So, majority of land owned by the minority of people. This is, I don't have to tell you, it's widely problematic for a lot of this land to just be taken and seized with no compensation, no recourse. This was completely just stolen. In 2024, the expropriation bill was passed, and this was just to kind of reaffirm eminent domain that the country was already using, in which they expanded public interest within eminent domain to include the nation's commitment to land reform and to reforms to bring about equitable access to all South Africa's natural resources. So this kind of expanded to be more about distribution of land, and also helping to reform the land so that it wasn't completely skewed in such a crazy way where only this 11% of the population owned all of this land, and to make it a little bit more equitable. The one thing with this law is that part of it is that they may or may not receive just compensation. Now, this has been quite contentious because people don't like the idea of not receiving just compensation. However, that doesn't necessarily mean they're not receiving any compensation. It just means they might not be receiving just compensation. So previously in South Africa, they used a willing buyer, willing seller model, which basically meant that these farms could jack up their prices as high as they wanted and the government would have to pay them. And that was that. Like, artificially high prices, not a very good model. And so this is basically just to combat that and say like, hey, we might give you a little bit below market value. However, this bill has also led to a lot of misunderstandings and miscommunications through the U.S., and so the current administration has levied a lot of tariffs on South Africa for fear of white people having their land taken from them. Although that's not actually what's happening. It's more redistribution. It's a little bit more complicated and a little hard to explain, but ultimately the whole goal with this was to not become Zimbabwe. And Zimbabwe did something similar, but without any legal oversight. So the president, who I think was deposed via a coup or something similar, basically pass a similar idea, but without any courts or aid. And so it ended up with people just storming farms and ended up very violently, you know, taking back of land by force. And that was a really, really bad model. And the world, I think, is seeing South Africa and worried that it'll turn into Zimbabwe, when it will not, because they have a lot more law and legality involved in the process. But this is a really interesting way to use eminent domain to be more about taking back any stolen land and equitable redistribution of resources, and less about like, hey, I need to take this for some public good that includes building a stadium or for wealth generation. So really, if we look at these three case studies, they all use eminent domain in very, very different ways. And thinking about eminent domain as a policy, it's clear that it's not a one-size-fits-all situation, right? It's not like eminent domain is always going to be the answer, or it's never going to be the answer. It's simply a tool in the toolbox, and whether or not it's used is quite relevant for the situation it's in. The reclamation of land is one thing. Developing the state economically is another thing. Displacing families is another thing. And so you really need to weigh whether or not that public interest is maintained, and the public interest for who. Are we taking land from minorities and giving it for some kind of public good that ultimately will not benefit those minorities? Because if we're doing that, then the ends do not justify the means in any way possible. And so I think that's something that we need to consider as the conversations of eminent domain continue forth and still become relevant in the news cycle today. And so briefly, just kind of looking over the future of eminent domain, we still see these ideas of high-speed rail, sports venues being built, and the Olympics. The Olympics typically doesn't use eminent domain, but it gets people thinking about other developments that can happen in the area. Renewable energy initiatives, economic strength, and land restoration all kind of are still existing in the world today and are part of the conversation. So in total, like, this whole idea of public versus private benefit is still being weighed to this day, and it's really important to think about how eminent domain can and cannot be justified, and also how governments can make up for harm done in the past. Particularly looking at LA, the Dodgers haven't done or said anything in particular that makes up for the harm that was done in Chavez Ravine, and it's unlikely they ever will say anything simply because of the reputation at the time. But I think it's really, really pertinent to be considering these ideas of, okay, a government has committed harm to do something for the public good. How do you balance those two factors? And it's a really tough question. I think it's one that I'll continue to think about as eminent domain still remains relevant in the legal system today. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Jackie On. I'll catch you in the next one.